Had the Germans won the war, they would have slaughtered the 5 million additional Jews documented at Wannsee and, if able to, Jews beyond Europe, especially in the United States. They would have slaughtered everywhere mentally ill and developmentally disabled people, all people they called gypsies, and Poles, Ukrainians, Russians, and other peoples to their east in the tens of millions as they refashioned the Eurasian continent and humanity. They would have slaughtered or prevented the birth of children as the biological seeds of peoples they wanted to destroy or numerically control or considered superfluous. As they moved into Africa and Asia, they would have slaughtered or let perish untold millions of various subhumans, Asians being deemed racial cripples and blacks semi-apes. Had the Germans won the war, they would have destroyed civilization and humanity as we know it. If the communists were a heresy on Western civilization, accepting many of its fundamental values and tenets, if in a perverted way, the Nazis were an apostasy, seeking its destruction and replacement by a German racial dominion, a world of masters and, of those permitted to live, mainly slaves. After 70 years of communist rule, Russia, Ukraine, the Baltics, and elsewhere, the countries and peoples resumed control of their futures. After almost half a century of Soviet domination in Central Europe, in Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and elsewhere, the country's peoples emerged intact and educated, and able to pick up, much the poorer in many ways, where they had been nationally and culturally. Had the Nazis ruled these same lands for half or three quarters of a century, no Ukraine or Ukrainian people, no Poland or Polish people, no Russia or Russian people would have been left to resuscitate. The Germans would have repopulated their lands with colonists, slaughtered and enslaved their peoples, obliterated their religions and churches, their cultures and communities. The Germans developed plans to begin this vast systematic destruction, most notably the General Plan for the East, and had in almost no time already started to implement their desires. After half a century or more under a victorious Nazi Germany, European, Western, even pre-Nazi German civilization would have been destroyed, unrecognizable, incapable of resurrection. Such was Nazism's caesura with Western civilization. Such was its unparalleled destructiveness. No general structural view of mass murder or elimination can account for each individual system's perpetrators' enormously variable treatment of their potential victims and then, once an eliminationist campaign begins, of the different groups they actually victimize. Such structural accounts, precisely because they deem irrelevant the perpetrator's conception of the victims, imply, instead of such variation, a structurally, authority-based, or psychologically or socially-psychologically induced uniformity in treatment. Different potential target groups' different objective political challenges or threats also cannot explain the perpetrator's varied treatment of potential and actual victims, because most victims posed no threat. After the eliminationist regimes quickly consolidated control, they faced almost no organized domestic political opposition, especially the extremely popular Nazis, widely seen as legitimate in Germany. Each country's people were in varying combinations supportive or prostrate. Aside from political leaders' strategic decisions about timing and scope, eliminationist programs' local and regional implementation varies for two principal reasons. Highly centrally organized mass slaughters and eliminations tend to produce more consistency. In those with greater depth and breadth of the target group's dehumanization and/or demonization, the perpetrators and the supporting population tend to treat the victims more uniformly. Thus, less centrally controlled eliminationist assaults can produce substantial regional and local variation, depending on local leaders' decisions and variable local beliefs about the targets. This occurred in Cambodia because the Khmer Rouge's regional cadres were somewhat differently oriented toward the eliminationist project. In Rwanda, because depending on local leaders and local Hutu-Tutsi relations, some communes and villages Hutu were easier to unleash into mass murderous assaults, while in others more Hutu dissented and resisted. And in Indonesia, because the centrally initiated and directed murderous assault depended greatly on local leaders and self-organizing groups of executioners, producing substantial regional variation owing to the nature of the hatreds and pre-existing communal conflicts. A better and more differentiated understanding of the relationship between eliminationist assaults, centralized initiation and organization, and their local organization and implementation requires far more knowledge about most individual eliminationist programs than we have. Similarly, far too little is known about the percentage of dissenters and resistors among perpetrators and among the peoples in whose name the perpetrators act. In many eliminationist assaults, as we now know, little evidence exists of widespread principled disapproval of the general eliminationist project itself or the specific killings, expulsions, and incarcerations, either among the perpetrators or broader populaces, which reflects their dehumanized and/or demonized conception of the victim's considerable depth and breadth. Nevertheless, any eliminationist politics has dissenters and resistors, some of whom succeed. Knowing more, substantially more, about their numbers and nature, we know so little probably because usually they were small minorities, would considerably deepen our understanding of individual eliminationist assaults and the occasional variation in their implementation's success. Communal worlds. While significant, dissenters, both individuals and small groups, receive disproportionate attention compared to an overwhelmingly important but neglected theme, the perpetrators' communities. In Hitler's Willing Executioners, I wrote about the Holocaust's perpetrators in a manner that restored their humanity. I treated them fully as human beings, having views about their deeds and making decisions about how to act, not as abstractions wrested from their lives' real social contexts, but as they actually were embedded in their social relations. Such an approach was, at the time, absent, even stridently opposed. The German perpetrators of the Holocaust and of eliminationist and exterminationist assaults on Poles, Russians, Sintis, Romas, and other targeted peoples operated within broader communities. They undertook their deeds often over long periods, always with considerable time on their hands to reflect. They had social lives. Wives and girlfriends accompanied many of them, many of whom also became perpetrators. The perpetrators went to church, played sports, even organized athletic competitions. They attended cultural events, went to movies, and had parties. They wrote revealing letters to loved ones and went home on furlough. Most of all, they talked. While on duty, while off duty, while eating meals and driving places, among themselves and others, discussing the day's events, their historic deeds, and more. Those many German perpetrators carrying out their brutal eliminationist tasks in Germany itself, especially in the camps densely blanketing the country, often lived at home. After a day of mistreating and brutalizing and even killing victims, they returned to their families, had dinner, played with their children. They spent time with friends, also went to church, and did all the social and communal things, including talking about work, that people do. What is true about the German perpetrators' rich social and communal lives is also obviously true, a commonplace, about other mass eliminations perpetrators. Yet if you pretend people killing, expelling, or brutalizing others are atomized individuals, are under authority's hammer or intense social psychological pressure with no capacity to think, or are bureaucratic abstractions instead of real human beings, if you toss around mind-deadening phrases such as banality of evil, or obedience to authority, or group pressure, or treat mass murder as if an artificial social psychological environment, such as the Zimbardo experiment of a tiny number of people, 24, for a short time, 6 days, with no experimental controls to speak of, so it was not really an experiment in a scientific or social scientific sense, is a guide to its perpetrators' reality and existences as people with families, friends, and communal lives. Or if you postulate these fictive and dehumanizing reductions of the perpetrators as a tautological account of their actions, and, more broadly, as a way of conceiving and discussing them, then there is no reason, as we have seen, to investigate how they come to hold their views about the world and their victims, or even what those views are. There is also no reason to examine the perpetrators in their multiple communal contexts while committing their eliminationist acts, or to examine their social relations, ways of living, and activities. The hard-headed questions we ask to ascertain the perpetrators' motives and their sources, and the bystanders' attitudes and their sources, also provide answers that can be built upon to explore the perpetrators' relationship to the bystanders, helping to form the communal contexts of the perpetrators' eliminationist actions and lives. The analytically unfortunate fact is that we know little about eliminationist perpetrators' communal lives. Some perpetrators in the Soviet Gulag's frozen reaches were removed from conventional social life. Yet many other eliminationist perpetrators are like the Germans, going home to dinner and out with friends, partaking in cultural events, attending church, talking about their deeds with others and among themselves, comparing notes, swapping stories, and discussing their deeds' historic significance, and carrying on with their lives. This was so for the Japanese in Asia, the British in Kenya, the Indonesians slaughtering communists, the communist Chinese, the Tutsi in Burundi, the Serbs in Bosnia, the Hutu in Rwanda, the political Islamists in Sudan, and so many more, certainly of most perpetrators killing people within their own country. As do other Hutu executioners, Leopold Twagira Yizu conveys the easy conversational and convivial nature of the perpetrators' talk and social lives. In the evening we told about Tutsi who had been obstinate, those who had gotten themselves caught, those who had gotten away. Some of us had contests, others made predictions or bets to win an extra primus, beer. The bragging amused us, even if you lost, you put on a smile. The evidence strongly suggests that perpetrators live in a milieu overwhelmingly supporting and affirming their treatment of the victims in the name of and for their people. As with eliminationist assaults, many other aspects, if broad-principled opposition or dissent had existed, then there would be abundant credible contemporaneous evidence about it. It does not. Nothing suggests that family and friends, or community members generally, saw or treated the perpetrators with disapproval, let alone the withering condemnation that would be directed at those considered among humanity's worst criminals. Nothing suggests that family, friends, and community members treated the killing and other eliminationist acts as anything more distasteful than an unpleasant part of a necessary eliminationist time and project. Nothing suggests that the perpetrators' community and social and recreational lives were normalcy's salve to guilty consciences. And nothing suggests that their communities were saying to them, "You are a good man despite what you do." Rather, the communal verdict was, "You are a good man because of what you do." Nothing suggests that during eliminationist onslaughts, the perpetrators' existences are psychically and social-relationally fragmented. Rather, they consisted of integrated selves with integrated minds in integrated communities with their self-conceived heroic, violent acts on behalf of their country, their people, their God, or humanity, harmonizing with their communal existences and with family, friends, and acquaintances. In Indonesia, throughout Bali, whole villages, including children, took part in an island-wide witch hunt for communists, who were slashed and clubbed and chopped to death by communal consent. In Bosnia, the ethnic Serbian community was so supportive of the eliminationist assault and so deeply complicit and involved that the extremely knowledgeable Alisa Murat-Kaos, president of the Association of Concentration Camp Torture Survivors in Sarajevo, maintains that a lot of people from Republika Srpska, Bosnian Serbs, were involved in crimes, and I think that actually maybe 70 or 80% of Republika Srpska's population should be actually punished in prison, in jail. Adamant that she does not mean they merely supported the crimes of raping, torturing, expelling and killing people, destroying their houses and more, she explains that they actually committed crimes. People who returned to their original community meet very often their perpetrators, who say, oh, hi, hello. In Rwanda, an in-depth study about one community of killers shows how the perpetrators slaughtered their victims with incredible cruelty and lived their lives with family, friends, and community in a thoroughly integrated and symbiotic way. Jean Hatzfield, its author, writes, in 1994, between 11 in the morning on Monday, April 11, and 2 in the afternoon on Saturday, May 14, about 50,000 Tutsi out of a population of around 59,000 were massacred by machete, murdered every day of the week from 9:30 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon by Hutu neighbors and militiamen on the hills of the commune of Nyamata in Rwanda. This, he adds, is the point of departure of this book. Although we need more evidence to draw firmly grounded general conclusions for certain eliminationist assaults, the substantial existing evidence suggests that, overwhelmingly, ordinary people moved by their hatreds and prejudices, by their beliefs in victims' evil or noxiousness, by their conviction that they and others ought to eliminate the victims, support their countrymen, ethnic group members, or village or communal members killing, expelling, or brutalizing others, as Germans did during the Nazi period, as Poles of Jedwabne did, as the people of Central and Eastern Europe did regarding ethnic Germans, as British settlers in Kenya did, as Bosnian Serbs did, and as Hutu across Rwanda did. The killers and those near them in their cities, towns, and villages, and especially those emotionally dear to them, constitute mutually supportive eliminationist communities. Alphonse Hitia Remyi, a Hutu mass murderer, conveys how the Nyamata commune's ordinary Hutu had this unmistakably affirmed, starting with the killing's first day, a machete butchering orgy of 5,000 Tutsi holed up in the local church and then in San Marta Maternity Hospital. The first evening, coming home from the massacre in the church, our welcome was very well put together by the organizers. We all met up back on the soccer field. Guns were shooting in the air, whistles and such like musical instruments were sounding. The children pushed into the center all the cows rounded up during the day. Burgomaster, the mayor, Bernard, offered the 40 fattest ones to the Interahamwe to thank them, and the other cows to the people to encourage them. We spent the evening slaughtering the cattle, singing and chatting about the new days on the way. It was the most terrific celebration. The perpetrators of mass annihilation and elimination know they exist in supportive eliminationist milieus. They themselves witness the open communal expressions of support. The eliminationist campaign against the Jews was immensely popular among Germans, not only during the pre-exterminationist phase of the 1930s, as everyone in Germany knew, the regime and ordinary Germans alike openly celebrated it with fanfare, but also during the mass murderous phase starting in 1941. To see how this knowledge of the Germans' broad base of support for the Jews' elimination was acted upon by the regime, shared by German bystanders, and communicated by the perpetrators to their loved ones, we need merely to look to Europe's largest concentration of Jews, the Warsaw Ghetto Camp in the heart of Poland's capital. Did the German leadership try to hide 500,000 Jews in human conditions? Not at all. In the midst of the Germans' all-out extermination of the Jews, the German Labor Front's recreational organization for German workers called Strength Through Joy organized coach tours of the ghetto where the Germans were starving the Jews to death on fewer than 400 calories a day. The Polish government in exile reported in May 1942, "Every day large coaches come to the ghetto. They take soldiers through as if it was a zoo. It is the thing to do to provoke the wild animals. Often soldiers strike out at passers-by with long whips as they drive through. They go to the cemetery where they take pictures. They compel the families of the dead and the rabbis to interrupt the funeral and to pose in front of their lenses. They set up genre pictures. Old Jew above the corpse of a young girl." The brutality, whips, the photographing, the mocking, the joyfulness and obvious approval, already seen and further discussed momentarily, these recurring features of eliminationist assaults were apparent, one, in the tourism itself, common among German bystanders where perpetrators brutalized or slaughtered Jews, two, in the acts of these coachloads of ordinary Germans, and, of course, three, for all the perpetrators in Warsaw and other places hosting such tourists to see. The regime, knowledgeable of Germans' broad solidarity with their eliminationist project, also made films of the ghetto, showing them in Germany. Alfred Rosenberg, the chief Nazi ideologist and Germany's minister for the occupied Eastern Territories, addressing the country's press department after he himself visited the ghetto, wrote in a manner capturing Germans' common knowledge of this eliminationist assault's character, great support for it, and transmutation of ordinary emotional responses into their opposite upon beholding Jews. "I had the opportunity to get to know the ghetto in Lublin and the one in Warsaw. The sights are so appalling and probably also so well known to the editorial staffs that a description is presumably superfluous. If there are any people left who still somehow have sympathy with the Jews, then they ought to be recommended to have a look at such a ghetto. Seeing this race en masse, which is decaying, decomposing, and rotten to the core, will banish any sentimental humanitarianism." Germans, seeing people in a state ordinarily evoking compassion and pity, are expected, when the people are this race, to behold them as a physical embodiment of their true, hateful nature. We have no reason to believe they did otherwise. After the Germans had methodically deported to Treblinka's gas chambers the Warsaw ghetto's inhabitants they had not already starved to death, the surviving Jews decided to go down fighting, rebelling in April 1943, until after a month the overwhelmingly militarily superior Germans crushed them. Many Germans celebrated the ghetto's utter destruction. Air Force Sergeant Herbert Habermaltz, wanting to make his comrades similarly joyful, wrote his former place of employment, a farm equipment manufacturer, a letter that, as letter writers knew, was likely to circulate among the workers. "We flew several circles above the city, and with great satisfaction we could recognize the complete extermination of the Jewish ghetto. There our folks did really a fantastic job. There is no house which has not been totally destroyed." That Habermaltz wrote without thinking he needed to explain to them anything about the complete extermination of a Jewish ghetto once containing nearly 500,000 Jews merely confirms what a vast array of sources definitively show. The Jews' systematic annihilation was well known and well supported among Germans, so much so that Habermaltz unabashedly termed the job done fantastic. To develop a systematic and comparative understanding of the perpetrators' social existences and communal lives and how their social embeddedness affects or reflects treatment of their victims, we need to examine the perpetrators' various communities and social relations. We must replace the fictitious general image of the frightened, atomized, isolated killer, said to exist under a regime's draconian authority or under group pressure, with a realistic account of the perpetrator's social, psychological, and moral communal existences. These vary substantially across eliminationist assaults, and even within given eliminationist assaults, when a particular eliminationist program covers large territories or long periods. The framework for the needed extensive empirical inquiry into the perpetrators' communal lives in individual eliminations and then comparatively distinguishes five principal kinds of communities that form the social context for the perpetrators' actions. First, the community of the perpetrators themselves, including but not restricted to men serving in the same camp, mobile killing squad, death march, or other eliminationist institutions. Second, the broader non-perpetrator communities in which they are embedded while eliminating their victims. These consist of local cities and towns where the perpetrators are stationed, whether at home or abroad, and the social communities and lives their governments and institutions at times create for them. Third, their home communities, to which most of them will return, of family, friends, neighbors, acquaintances, and fellow members of their local national, ethnic, or communal groups. Fourth, related to the third, the more abstract, though given the power of nationalism and ethnic or religious group membership to move people, hardly trivial, larger national, ethnic, religious, or political communities. Fifth, far more distant and less relevant for most perpetrators, the international community, the rest of humanity. The perpetrators live in all or most of these communities while they kill and eliminate their victims. Their physical and social existences are continuous in some, episodic in others, and non-existent or almost so in others. But in them all, though obviously varying substantially, the perpetrators are situated socially, psychologically, or morally, and even in those they do not physically inhabit while acting as perpetrators, they know they eventually will have some relationship of moral accountability, psychological influence, or social or political consequence. This knowledge is relevant, can be powerful, and should not continue to be discounted. Still, whatever is generally true about the perpetrators' various communities, including their general supportiveness, more can be said about each of them and their interconnectedness. Working in eliminationist institutions can be utterly normal, or at least can become utterly normal after a perpetrator's initial participation in an eliminationist operation, when the need to carry out the eliminationist assault seems unquestionable. Even among perpetrators viewing the victims as sufficiently noxious or threatening to warrant or necessitate their elimination, including lethally, some may doubt such actions' wisdom or morality. In such circumstances, a perpetrator's comrade's validation of the violence, or the knowledge that he operates under the state's aegis, the nation's or the perpetrator's ethnic or religious group's representative and guardian, can help quell a perpetrator's lingering doubts. The eliminationist regime's character and the specific eliminationist institution's character can affect the perpetrator's understanding of their deeds and their lives' quality while killing, expelling, torturing, and immiserating their victims. Some regimes and killing institutions, such as the Germans, were organized and hierarchical and relatively lax and understanding toward the perpetrators. They were also characterized by considerable off-duty comradeship and conviviality. Some, also organized and hierarchical, are harsher, as the Guatemalan mobile killing squads could be. Others have more variable, fluid, and intermittent qualities, such as that of the far less formally organized and hierarchical Hutu. The Hutu's killing operations character depended on whether the villagers were left on their own for a given day's killing expeditions, villagers not feeling up to joining that day's hunt stayed behind, or they were under the supervision of the Interahamwe, which sometimes forbade a day off. But for the reasons already established and more addressed momentarily, the various eliminationist institutions' other features, from their hierarchical structures, the actual or implied coercion that might exist, the normative world of support for killing and elimination, have not been the perpetrators' prime movers and could not have been given their actual conduct. Sometimes when killers speak frankly, they, in a jumble, adduce a host of factors and circumstances that composed the mass murderous complex of their actions. But when doing so, there is an assumption, explicit or clearly implicit, of underlying consent to the deed, born of their shared conception of the targeted peoples as noxious or threatening, of deserving their fate. Some Rwandan perpetrators speak in such a logically incoherent but psychologically plausible muddle. At one moment, they discuss how they got drunk on their greed for looting. At another moment, they mention that the Interahamwe, dedicated executioners, would not permit them to take a day off, or would reproach them for not killing an acquaintance, or would fine them for not going into the bush to kill. Hardly a plausible burden, as it was easily paid from their looting's proceeds, or would threaten them with death for not killing. At yet another moment, the same perpetrators openly state that they and their comrades and all Hutu hated the Tutsi, thought the Tutsi were not human beings but snakes, cockroaches, and vermin who wanted to enslave all Hutu. So they believed it imperative to free their country of the Tutsi scourge. So they cut them. Eli Ingarambi, in a work camp prison when I interviewed him, also speaks in such a vein, asserting, among other things, that he was coerced, as were other Hutu. But then, when trying to convey to me the character of the genocide and the various facets of what really happened, says and indicates in many ways that he and ordinary Hutu, perpetrators and bystanders alike, hated the Tutsi, thought them not to be human beings, wanted to destroy them, and pursued or supported these goals with amazing and cruel vigor. When asked, were most Hutu happy to get rid of the Tutsi in one way or another, even if they themselves didn't want to do the killing? He replies, they felt like they should be eliminated and wiped out, explaining that Hutu shared the government's bad ideology, which told them to start from a small child, continue with a pregnant woman, kill her with her husband, her in-laws, and all her families, eliminate them all, eat their things. After you finish everything, take their land, take their cars. Think of how long they have been fighting against us. Ingarambi is emphatic. The Hutu wanted to eliminate all of the Tutsi. They did not want to see anyone surviving. Ingarambi has confessed to participating in the killing of only two people, but similarly in the course of his own testimony, some quoted here, betrays himself, repeatedly making it clear that he was daily in the thick of the mass murder, participating in the butchery of many more. Author's note. Another example. We peasants, we were using our traditional weapons. It is for that reason that when you were hacking, you were supposed to cut the Tutsi into two pieces. There was times where you would hack him and not cut him into two pieces, and you hurt him only and think that he was dead. Let's say that we are going in the squad that is going to kill and loot. We meet someone, and we are almost five of us. One of us says, let's see who is going to be the first to hack him. The one who hacks the first runs, and the second one also hacks and runs. The complex interactive effects of various influences upon some perpetrators, and yet their willingness and conviction in the rightness of the principle of eliminating the targeted people, and of the killing itself that are the foundation of the perpetrators' deeds, and the members of their enormously supportive societies or groups' views about what ought to be done, are captured also by others. Pankras Hakizamungili discourses in a jumble about having no choice, having hesitations, including those born of what will happen should they fail, which a good organizer can quell, and about his and the other Hutus' hatred for the Tutsi, their enthusiasm in going on the hunt, and their relief at finally ridding themselves of the Tutsi. And so, from Pancras's mouth come words that could serve as a motto for our age's willing executioners, whether ordinary Germans, ordinary Serbs, or ordinary Hutu. You obey freely. The second kind of community, the communities physically encompassing or abutting the perpetrators while at their eliminationist tasks, forms the perpetrators' immediate social context. These communities vary enormously. If the perpetrators are killing in their own country but not near home, they live as visitors or temporary residents. If in a conquered or colonial area, their government or they and their compatriots construct a local perpetrator community, the nearby victim peoples usually being communally irrelevant. These can vary from settlers' communities, as the British had in Kenya, the Germans created in Poland and elsewhere, and the Chinese established in Tibet, to imperial garrison communities with impromptu human and institutional infrastructural support, as the Japanese had in conquered areas and the Germans had in some of theirs. Everyone in such communities knows about the perpetrators' deeds. They see them. They mingle with the perpetrators. They work with them. They often revel in the perpetrators' deeds. They service and supply them and collaborate with them in non-eliminationist activities. Such people are not formally perpetrators. Some do cross the line. Yet they implicate themselves in the deeds, or they so intimately rub shoulders with the perpetrators that they belong to the perpetrator community. Everything suggests they are consensual communities. The third community, consisting of the perpetrators' families, neighbors, and towns, powerfully exists for all mass annihilations and eliminations perpetrators, though differently depending on when the perpetrators work their violence. Perpetrators, usually sooner than later, visit or return to their families and home communities, to loved ones, friends, and others who often, probably usually, know at least the basics of the perpetrators' deeds. The perpetrators must inevitably consider how these people will judge their deeds. In many mass eliminations, perpetrators operate in their home environs. As they brutalize, expel, and kill people, they, embedded in those communities day and night, do not have to wonder what their families and communities will someday say. This was true of those in Turkey attacking Armenian death marches as they trudged by impromptu perpetrators' towns, of the enormous number of Germans guarding or servicing camps in their own cities, towns, and neighborhoods, of Indonesians slaughtering communists, of Serbs in Bosnia, Tutsi in Burundi, Hutu in Rwanda, and more. Beyond their local communities is the larger reference group of the nation, the people, the political movement, the tribe, or the religious group in whose name perpetrators act. Perpetrators kill, expel, and incarcerate their victims to secure the future for themselves and their families by reconstituting society. As we repeatedly see, they also understand themselves to be acting for their larger communities. What will be their personal legacies to their people? How do they expect their people to see and judge them, to thank and celebrate, or to shun and punish them? Such considerations unquestioningly affect many perpetrators, potentially all of them. Finally, there is the international community, or humanity. The real human beings, not the abstraction of humanity moving many communists, or the Germans and the Japanese's restricted racist conceptions of humanity consigning peoples to subhumanity. Perpetrators facing their victims likely do not think much about the international community. Yet, as much testimony indicates, the perpetrators are aware of a larger world, which they usually understand will condemn their actual and prospective eliminationist violence. In the past several decades, the spread of telecommunications has made perpetrators increasingly aware their acts will receive international scrutiny. Nevertheless, most perpetrators appear but tenuously connected psychologically to these distant and rather abstract community considerations. After all, when perpetrators face the work of demons who wage their battle against us, or other putatively threatening or problematic subhumans, people across an ocean or over a border or two must seem irrelevant. Political leaders initiating and overseeing eliminationist assaults, however, are acutely conscious, if often ultimately dismissive, of the international community. The critical issue taken up in Chapter 11 is how to vastly increase the international community's psychological and moral centrality and relative weight among the perpetrators' various more immediate communities. For actual or prospective perpetrators, from the man on the ground, gun or machete in his hand, to his immediate commanders, to those running eliminationist institutions, and especially to the political leaders unleashing and orchestrating the eliminationist assault. Few, if any, perpetrators likely self-consciously disaggregate their embeddedness in various communities or regularly assess how each community and its many members, even leaving aside the distant international community, judge or will judge their deeds and ultimately them. For many, especially those working at home, no difference exists among some of their communities. For some, such as the Indonesians slaughtering communists and, even more so, Serbs in Bosnia and Hutu in Rwanda, the communities of killers, of immediate locale, of home, and even of the nation collapse into an integrated mass murderous and eliminationist consensual community. In addition to these instances, the judgment of communities, except the international one, is obviously generally a non-issue for killers, expellers, and guards. The perpetrators move in overlapping or intersecting communities approving their deeds so that acute moral doubt and existential discomfort do not arise. In addition to the expressed approval and acceptance various relevant communities give them, the perpetrators know that those belonging to their country, people, ethnic group, political movement, or religion, having been party to their society's conversation about the dehumanized or demonized victims, widely share their views. The perpetrators know they similarly believe the perpetrators' deeds are right and necessary, support them, are even thankful the perpetrators are eliminating the people they commonly hate or fear. Because the eliminationist logic of the perpetrator's beliefs applies equally to the many others sharing those beliefs who have not been asked to act upon them, it is abundantly clear that many other people in the perpetrator's communities and societies would also have brutalized, incarcerated, expelled, and killed the victim groups had they been asked or put in the position to do so. This, that the vast majority of ordinary Germans would have also been Hitler's willing executioners, I demonstrated for Germans during the Nazi period. Though for other eliminationist assaults, the data do not lend themselves to the same methodologically inescapable, surefire generalization to the perpetrators' societies and communities, exceptions notwithstanding, we can still say for various reasons that so many others from those communities would have willingly acted as the perpetrators did. The perpetrators know this very well. The perpetrators do not necessarily ponder how the members of their various communities work through the logic of their beliefs and what they therefore think about the perpetrators' deeds or what they would do if mobilized for the eliminationist assault. Neither do soldiers in war. Absent demonstrable opposition at home, soldiers do not wonder about their countrymen's support or readiness to join them. They naturally assume both. So, too, the eliminationist perpetrators, conceiving of themselves, like soldiers, to be conducting a war against their people's dangerous enemies. The public discourse, more intensified, explicit, and public immediately preceding and during eliminationist assaults, about the need to exterminate the brute or to eliminate the plague, merely confirms to the perpetrators what the same discourse had already prepared them and their communities for. When governmental organs, civil leaders, newspapers, intellectuals, and religious leaders repeatedly publicly proclaim, as they have so often done, people's noxiousness and threat, and even call for their elimination, they further affirm what the perpetrators already know, having watched family, friends, and others nod in agreement or approvingly repeat what is in the air. The Jews are our misfortune, was one of the German public sphere's most oft-repeated phrases in the 1930s and 1940s. British colonial officials and ordinary settlers alike casually and reflexively spoke of the putatively savage, bloodthirsty, murderous Mau Mau. Ladino Guatemalans called Maya animals. Serbs, as a matter of course, referred to Bosnian Muslims as Turks, constructing them as the Serbs' historic and eternal enemy, and as Bosnia's rightless alien invaders. The Rwandan airwaves coursed with and Hutu newspapers and popular publications printed hate-filled accounts of the Tutsi cockroaches and calls to exterminate them. These and other commonplaces solidify the sense of a community of like-minded thought, values, hatreds, and actions among the perpetrators and those around them. Pankras, echoing so many others, explains, "The radios were yammering at us since 1992 to kill all the Tutsi," which found echoes in an activated and intensified Hutu conversation, as Christine reports. "In the cabarets, men had begun talking about massacres in 1992, with the president of their commune visiting their houses to see that the tools behind sacks of beans were well sharpened." A striking feature of prejudices and hatreds, of the dehumanizing and demonizing conceptions one group's members have for another's, is their intellectual and social leveling within communities and, whatever the specific beliefs differences, across societies and civilizations. In given eliminationist communities, university professors and high school-educated janitors share common murderous views about targeted people. The same talk animates the lecture hall and the beer hall, the principal difference being the little separating highfalutin nonsense from plain nonsense. The people of poets and thinkers, as the Germans, Europe's most highly educated people, liked to call themselves, were no different from illiterate Hutu farmers. Rwanda's adult literacy rate, at around 50%, was among the world's lowest. Intellectuals, lawyers, teachers, doctors, and clergy, the opinion leaders and, in some cases, especially the clergy, moral leaders, validate the eliminationist beliefs and acts of their society's ordinary members and prospectively further sustain the perpetrators' confidence in their people's solidarity. We have already explored how Serbian writers and intellectuals, including the country's most influential body of thinkers, the Serbian Academy of Arts and Sciences, laid down the common ideational foundation and even provided the political leadership for the Serbs' eliminationist assaults. German intellectuals, doctors, jurists, teachers, clergy critically contributed to spreading eliminationist anti-Semitism and other racist and dehumanizing views in Germany before and during the Nazi period. Shelves of books, including some of the very early scholarly works on Nazism and the Holocaust, bear such titles as Hitler's Professors, The Third Reich and Its Thinkers, The Nazi Doctors, Hitler's Justice, Revolutionary Anti-Semitism in Germany from Kant to Wagner. Such socially and culturally crucial people analogously prepared the ground for our time's other mass slaughters and eliminations, including those done in the name of Marx and the promised land he and his intellectual epigones promised. Vladimir Lenin, Leon Trotsky, and others who laid the foundation for and initiated the communists' long-term eliminationist assault on many portions of Soviet society were extremely intelligent men and authors of learned Marxist works. Pol Pot and other Khmer Rouge leaders were also relatively highly educated, having imbibed their foundational Marxism in Paris. In Rwanda, intellectuals prepared the Hutu for what was to come, as innocent Rawila Liza, a Tutsi survivor, explains. "Genocide is not really a matter of poverty or lack of education. In 1959, the Hutu relentlessly robbed, killed, and drove away Tutsi, but they never for a single day imagined exterminating them. It is the intellectuals who emancipated them by planting the idea of genocide in their heads and sweeping away their hesitations." After the fact, some perpetrators, finally seeing their deeds through the outside world's condemning eyes, reflect on how their intellectuals, elites, and clergy led them astray.